Good evening. My name is David Dignard, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
My sobriety date is July 14th, 1999, and I'm a member of the Happy Destiny Big Book Study. And so I'm over on Route 17 at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church. And we meet on Monday night at 8 o'clock. And,
7 o'clock.
Oh, sorry, 7 o'clock. It is now 8 o'clock. I apologize if I feel a little uncomfortable up here at times. We were talking earlier, I have an old man bad back that I kind of threw out today, so I might move around a little bit. So I'm supposed to say, tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I will try to do that to the best of my ability. I have a terrible memory, and I get dates, even from early in sobriety, kind of mixed up. And so I'll just do the best I can, be honest. So I grew up here in Portsmouth, or down the road in Portsmouth, and I've lived around here pretty much all my life. My family was, I guess you would say, a average, lower middle class family. My mom and dad worked, and I have one brother, and we didn't have a lot, but we had everything we needed. I grew up with no alcohol in my house. We went to church on Sunday and did sports. Grew up kind of, I was a good kid. I was really, really good at studies and school and doing what I was supposed to do. I remember I was in the National Junior Honor Society when I was younger. And my brother, he was kind of like, I did sports, and he's 2 years younger than me, and he did art lessons and stuff like that, you know. And so he kind of got picked on a little bit, and I was his big brother, and it worked out, though. I guess I was introduced to alcohol at an early age. I'll go back a little bit. When I was growing up, I had a friend that lived down the street, and her name was Shannon Barnes, and we hung out a whole lot. You know, we were like friends. We weren't like boyfriend and girlfriend. We were just friends. Our parents played cards on the weekends, and they had a pool, and you know, the kids all would congregate down there and everything. And when she was 14 years old, one day she didn't come to school. So we called down there, what's wrong? She was sick. The next day, she didn't come to school, so we called down there. And she had pneumonia, and she went to the hospital. And then the next day, she died. And she had what was a disease back then that they didn't know a lot about, I guess, but it was called Reye syndrome. And that was kind of like a turning point in my life, because there was the good kids at school that did their studies and did what they were supposed to do, and then there was the other kids at the school. And after that, I kind of like, I guess I got an attitude of, life's too short. I'm going to go live it to the fullest. I'm going to see what else is going on out in this world. And so I started, I had a friend, and his dad had had a refrigerator in the garage that they drilled a tap through and put a tap on the refrigerator in the garage, and it had Miller beer. And that's kind of where it all started. We would go there after school before the parents got home and drink beer. And I can't tell you exactly when I had my first drink. I do not remember it. I just remember doing that stuff. We would get vodka and bring it into school and put it in our Hawaiian punch or whatever, you know, and drink it during class. It got bad when I was a teenager. You know, when I was 15 years old, 16 years old, I was drinking regularly, you know, and we could get it. We had some older friends, and we could get it wherever we wanted to. And there wasn't any repercussions yet, but people saw that, other people that in school and stuff saw that, you know, that I was, alcohol affected me. I could tell that it did. Right before I walked up here, Ernie says, make sure you tell the yearbook story. So I'll tell the yearbook story. It's from my sophomore year in high school. You know, you get the yearbooks and you pass them around, and this girl, and I was looking at it. I got a picture of it somewhere in my phone, but this girl named Julie, she writes in there to, you know, to a nice guy, a sweet guy, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You know, hope we get to see each other some this summer. And make sure you go to all the AA meetings. And I was like, okay. So, and I was kind of taken back at it, but I didn't take it like I had a problem with alcohol. I was worried my parents were going to see it, so I kind of just hid the book. I didn't even cross it out. I could have just crossed it out, but I kept it for some reason. And, you know, it says in Bill's story where he walked in to the graveyard and read that tombstone with the old grenadier that, you know, dies by pot or beer or something. I don't know. I can't remember the effect. But it says it was an ominous warning he failed to heed when he read that tombstone about drinking and dying. And that was my ominous warning that I failed to heed. When I first read Bill's story, I thought of that, you know. And so I just, you know, I just kept on drinking. And so I got through high school. I did not do very well. My studies went down. You know, my high school wasn't very smart. It was Manor High School in Portsmouth, and I graduated like 45th out of 244 people. I remember that. I can remember that. But my grade point average was like a 2.4 or something. It was like there was 200 people between 2.4 and 2.0 that graduated. So not a stellar academic class of graduates at Manor High School in 1983. But I did good enough on some SATs, and I got accepted into a college, and I went to school. Now, during this time, I did have one battle with, I had repercussions from alcohol, like coming home and throwing up pickles in a bathtub after a basketball party, and parents catching me drinking, and my parents didn't know what to do about that, you know. And they just did the best they could. I would tell them a lie and then go do it all over again. And Then one time, before I got to college, the summer before I got to college, I was driving from a friend's house with a six-pack in my dad's car, and did something, and the policeman was pulling me over, and I got scared, and I just took off and ran through neighborhood and Green Lakes, threw the beers out the window, and one thing about you can outrun one policeman, but you cannot outrun the radio. And so about 10 police cars cornered me at Collinswood Bowling Alley and pulled all the guns out, and I did not get in trouble for alcohol. I got an attempt to elude. I told them I was scared. Ended up doing 2 weekends in Portsmouth City Jail before I ever went off to college, you know. And I learned a little bit there about life in Portsmouth City Jail. But so I went to school. I went to a college named Longwood College, and it just recently turned co-ed. And there was 2,000 students there, and it was like 5-to-1 girls to guys ratio. And I walked into that dining hall, and I was like, this place is for me. And that's exactly, it was in Farmville, Virginia, and it was way away from Portsmouth, and I'm coming here. And so I had arrived, and so I went there and, you know, joined a fraternity and just drank myself almost to death, you know. So when I drank from the beginning, I drank and I wanted another and another and another until it was all gone. And that was from the first time when we would get to Roger's dad's keg until all the way through college and all the way through my drinking career. I never really drank socially. It was always sport drinking to me. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. And the effect never seemed to relieve the pressure. But it did make me, I was kind of awkward, but it did make me be able to dance. And, you know, I couldn't dance, but I would dance when I was drunk. And I could talk to girls when I was drunk, and I could socialize with whoever when I was drunk. And it worked for me. Now, along the lines, there was other things involved, which I will not get into. And as my drinking career progressed, the other things became more prominent. But, you know, through my college career, you know, I'm not going to sit here and list it, but I did get a few DUIs, and I got out of them, you know, and I got one, and then I got another one in the summer in the Outer Banks, and I got pulled over for weed, and you know, I had a bunch of run-ins with the law, on and off, but never really any serious consequences, because back then, in the late 80s, there wasn't a lot of computer talk between cities and counties and stuff like that like there is now. So I had like 3 first offense DUIs, and you know, nobody ever found out that I had one somewhere else in a different state and whatnot. So I just got out of them, you know. And then when I got out of school, I went to Longwood for 5 years, and I was on academic probation the last year and a half, 2 years. And I worked all through that, but I never graduated. I have more credits than I need to graduate college. I have a bachelor's degree in business in college, and I have a 1.9 grade point average still. I literally threw my parents' money away. But I got out of school, and I just, you know, I did what I did. You know, I moved to Virginia Beach and worked valet and started working in restaurants and bars and drank for effect and got in more trouble. And I got in enough trouble that I got two more second offense DUIs and ended up having to do some jail time for both of those. And ultimately got my license taken away for 10 years and moved back to Norfolk and worked bartending in a big place down in Waterside. I had a bike. I lived on Freemason Abbey and had a bike and rode to the bar and worked at night and rode back to Freemason Abbey and, you know, didn't have the problem. Worked at a big giant nightclub up there called Legends and ended up turning into Have a Nice Day Cafe. And I lived like a freaking vampire, you know. We were at after hours bars and after work until 6 a.m. And then I'd get up, sleep half the day, and go into work at, you know, 5 o'clock and do it all over again. And I was slowly killing myself, but, you know, got into some other things while I was living in Norfolk. And then, you know, that whole thing ran out, and I ended up moving back to Portsmouth and end up back at the parents' house, you know, 30 years old and back at your parents' house. During that whole time, I never had a long-term meaningful relationship with another human being. Of course, I had my parents and my brother and my family, but they were just them. They were the family. And I had the boys that I run around with, you know, the frat brothers and the friends that I made when I left college and stuff. But then the girls and that I dated and used and abused during that whole time, I never really formed. I had one girl that loved me to death, and I mean, I just, I never got it, you know. Other people that were my age or leaving college and marrying their sweethearts and stuff like that, I never did it. It was always all about me. And what y'all taught me later on, that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I can see how I lived my whole life selfishly from an early age, even though I didn't know that, you know. So I ended up at my parents' house for a little while, but I got with some friends and we moved in together. And so I got a job and I decided to stop working like a vampire, living like a vampire, and working at nights at the bars all the time. And I got a job with some guys I knew from school cutting down trees. So then, you know, I'm in my, I don't know how old it was, but I start cutting down trees. And so that's my new job, to work during the day to solve me from not having to work at nights. During this time, I was driving one day back from a buddy's house. I went over there to do some work. I was driving my roommate's truck, and they pulled this new thing over on Hodges Ferry Road where there's like no left turn between 4 and 6, some baloney like that. And so I get pulled over by the policeman. So I just told him, I don't have a driver's license. My wallet is at home. I did not lie to the guy, because there's beer cans in the back and everything, you know. So he had trainee on his policeman's badge, and so he just took down my name and number, and I drove away. And that ended up coming back to bite me. And I got, he wrote me a ticket, that's what it was. He wrote me a ticket for failure to turn, but I knew that was going to come back and bite me. Because once they realized that I did not have a license, that when I go pay this ticket, it was going to come up. So I ended up getting a lawyer, and I'm like, man, I'm in big trouble here. I'm 7 years into this 10-year no drive. I could have went back and got my license. I found out after 3 years, could have applied for it. But I'd been like 7 years with no license. But I was not locked up, and I wasn't in jail, and there was no problem. I just, you know, it says in our book, to me, my alcoholic life seemed normal. It seemed normal. And so I just kind of accepted that that's the way it was going to be. Even though some of those nights in that apartment, I would be all tore up, and I'd look out at the stars, and I'd go, you know, God, there's got to be a better way, you know. I was just living terribly, you know. Relationships with my parents and my grandparents and all were just, it was terrible. They didn't want me even around them, you know. And even though I would get invited to family events, I would skirt them and not show up or show up late or whatever. But anyway, so they ended up, this lawyer guy said, we need you to go do a drug test and this and that. I don't know. I had to go to ASAP and CSAP one time for DUIs, but I didn't graduate from those. I graduated from one of them, but I didn't do real well. So I knew a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous from the one I did in Virginia Beach. They made me go to some meetings and get a slip signed, and I did that and got out of that ASAP thing. But he said, well, there, you're in kind of a lot of trouble here, so you need to, first thing you need to do is go down to this place and pee in this cup, and we're going to get that settled. And I did that, and of course I wasn't drinking then, but that day, but I failed the urine screen for marijuana, so they were like, you can't come back again. He was like, we're going to try to beat this and go and get your license back. And he goes, they said, well, come back in 1 year, you know, or you're going to go to prison or something like that. I don't know. But whatever he worked out, he said, you need to start going to this place once a week. You need to stay clean, and I want you to go to some AA meetings. And I go, well, I know you can get a slip sign. What if I take a piece of paper with me and get this slip sign, get it signed, and then we can use that to go to the judge? And he was like, well, that seems like a great idea. So, you know, I just knew I was in a world of shit. And I remember at one of these ASAP meetings that I went to, I remember they had this video, and they had this picture on the wall, or this picture in the video, or whatever, and they were like, this is what a cirrhosis of the liver looks like. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that guy's got to be like in his 50s or 60s or something, you know. It's not going to happen to me for a long time, you know, because I could put off till tomorrow what I needed to do today a lot. I was a big time procrastinator. And if you ask my wife, and you see the state of my house, it's still true today. I got a back porch I still ain't finished. But So we go and I go get my bicycle because I don't have transportation. And I'm going to go. I looked up and there was a meeting at Maryview Hospital. And so I'm going to get on my bicycle and I got my yellow legal pad, piece of paper. And I rode up to Maryview Hospital. They had a newcomers meeting there. And so I go in and I remember they asked, was there any newcomers? And I stood up at that meeting and I said, my name's David, I'm an alcoholic and I had 5 DUIs. And I sat back down. And so they did the meeting and I don't know what was really said at the meeting. But after the meeting, I was walking out to my bike and this guy walks up to me. He starts talking to me and he's with another guy. And you know, he's like, well, you know, you're new and this and that. He's like, well, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, do me a favor. He said, read this. And I'll tell you who it was that guy over there. And it was page 21 of the big book. And I read it. And I read about me. I was a smart guy when I was young, and I had a bright future. And I tore it all down. And I was so intoxicated, I could just sleep the day, and then I'd get up and do it all over again. The things on that page that I read were about me. And he asked me, did that describe you at all? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, we can help you. And at this point, you know, I'm kind of running out of options, you know. And I'm kind of tired of looking up in the sky and figuring out there's got to be a better way. And so I decided, I said, yeah. I said, well, great. He said, well, are you willing to go to any length for recovery over alcohol? And I said, yeah, I guess, yeah. He said, well, can you make 90 meetings in 90 days? And I said, well, I don't know about that. I'm on a bike and I pointed over there and I don't know how I would do that. So this guy was slick. He had me set up. He goes, well, this guy here, his name's Mike. He goes, how long have you been coming to AA? He goes, I've been coming for 45 days or something like that. He goes, do you have a driver's license? He said, no. He goes, how do you get to meetings? He goes, well, I ride my bike, I take the bus, I hitchhike, I walk, I get rides. I go, okay, I got it. I'll try to go. I'll try the 90 meetings. And so he told me to go to this meeting. And actually, I don't think I went to the meeting the next night, but I went to the one on Thursday night or whatever. I had a lot of questions, and I knew the meetings weren't a place for questions and answers. So I ended up asking him to be my sponsor. And, you know, he said, we're going to do a couple things, and I'd do those things that might work out. You know, and so I started doing that. One of the things was call him in the morning. And I was like, well, I'm not living like a vampire anymore. I get up in the morning and go to work most mornings, but I was working for these guys and they were kind of rough around the edges. And I mean, I would, if you didn't show up to work, you got the next day off for free. And so I would call a guy on Thursday and say I'm drunk, you know. And he'd go, all right, you ain't got to come to work Monday, you know. And I'd have a four-day weekend, you know. We wouldn't get paid. But, you know, that was when I was just working for cash money and, you know, it was, you know. But and this time, during this time, when I have this lawyer and I have these bills from him, I'm going to his house out in the country and trimming all the trees on his farm for him. So I got a rope and I learned how to climb and cut down trees. So next thing I knew, the climber got drunk or fired or whatever, and I ended up starting to climb trees for a living and cut them down. So I got pretty good at that, and I did that for a number of years. So he took me to his home group and told me to do these things and call him in the morning and read the doctor's opinion, you know. And so I started doing what he told me to do. And we were members of, I joined the same home group he went to, and became members of Credit Study Group in Portsmouth. And that was a pretty intimidating crowd, even for a tree climber that was kind of rough around the edges himself. But these guys kind of told it like it was, you know. And so I started doing these things. He told me to pray to something in the morning, and go to these meetings, and started carrying me around. He was really involved in service, and I would go to these service meetings with him, and I learned what the GSR did. I think it was the first thing we started kind of doing, going to the district meeting. And I became a member of Credit Study Group, and I became involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I didn't realize it. I was just doing what I was told. I was tired of living the way I'd been living, and I guess I had had enough. One time, I was at home, and I was early in sobriety, and I remember my sink was full of dishes, dirty dishes. None of them were mine. See, I started doing these things, and I'm on a bike, and I'm living with two other guys, and there's stuff in the drawer, and there's beer in the refrigerator, and I'm trying to get sober, and I'm trying to change my life around, but I'm still living with guys and around people that are doing the same thing that I've been doing for a long time. And so I'm doing one thing totally different, and I'm starting to try to change my life, and these guys are just doing what they had done, what we had all done beforehand. And they're starting to piss me off a little bit because they're living like a bunch of slobs, but they're just living like the slob I used to be, you know. So I'm pissed off, and I'm like, these guys are, they're not, the dish sinks full, and they're not putting the dishes up, and we had a dishwasher, you know, and I'm talking about sponsor, and I'm just having a meltdown, and he says, clean the dishes, and call me back, click. And hung up the phone. I don't know if you remember doing that or not. But I'm like, what is this guy? Okay. So it took me less than 5 minutes to take those dishes that I was all pissed about and put them in the dishwasher to clean. So I called him back 4 or 5 minutes later. He's like, what do you say all of a sudden? What's the problem? You know, I was getting a little above my raisin, so to say. I was getting a little holier than thou around these guys that I was with, because they're just doing what they're doing. They're just doing the best they can do. And I was just doing the best I could do. These guys started, one friend of mine, he started saying, how come you never want to hang out with us anymore? You know? And he goes, you're always going to those meetings and you're not doing anything. And this is a friend of mine, Jeff Sutherland, and he says, and I said, well, the way I've learned it from these guys is that I have this disease and it'll kill me. I go, if I had cancer and I needed to go to chemotherapy every night for an hour to save my life, would that be okay with you? And he said, yes. And I said, well, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to a meeting every night to try to save my life. And I could see changes coming on, you know. Now, I really wanted to get a girlfriend and stuff like that, new in sobriety. And my sponsor told me to get I wasn't with a female or anything like that. And sponsor told me to get a plant, you know, and I didn't get a plant. I got a dog, and I kept him alive for a while. But, I kept him alive for as long as I had him. And I ended up giving him to an AA member. And I think he took him for a walk, long walk in the woods. That's another story. But he starts taking me through these steps. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and go through every step with you. I need to figure out what time it is. Oh, it's 8:42. I'm not sitting here yet. So he starts going through these steps with me. And I am willing to do the 4-step, but it took me a while to do it. To go back a minute, they used to say this thing, there's about the 3rd step, and because they told me to keep it simple, stupid at the beginning, and even back farther at the beginning, I remember this one home group member. I'd said some stuff. I spoke at a meeting when I was like 6 months sober, and I had a traffic study group, and I started, I don't know, some bunch of gobbledygook, and after the meeting, this old timer, he comes up to the meeting, and he goes, David, he goes, if you ever get called to speak at a meeting, I want you to say, my name is David, and I'm an alcoholic, and that's all I know. He goes, because that's all you know about staying sober right now. And I took that to heart. And I didn't say anything in a meeting for another 6 months, except when my sponsor said I could speak, I could comment at the newcomer meeting, because there was newcomers there that had 1 day, 20 days, 5 days, or whatever. And I had 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. And so I was productive at the newcomer meeting. Because I could only tell them what I'd done to this point to stay sober, you know. And that was pretty much follow directions. So we get to this 3rd step prayer, and they used to say, if there's 3 frogs sitting on a tree and one makes a decision to jump, how many frogs are on the tree? And I learned there's still 3 frogs on the tree. One just made a decision to jump. He didn't jump yet. And that's what step 3 was for me. I just made a decision. Jumping was writing down that 4th step. And that's when we're into action. So he got me going on the fourth step, and I was reluctant at first, and really, it's not that difficult if you sit down and do it. You know, they took me in the corner and said, you know, the hardest thing about doing it is just doing it, you know. And so I finally just did it, and then I went over to his house, and we talked about it. And there was one thing I didn't write down on that paper. I wasn't ever going to write it down, but ended up telling him about it, and he had something similar to share, and it really wasn't that bad, you know. There's an old joke about, you know, a guy got so drunk he screwed a chicken, and the chicken died, you know. Basically, I kind of told him that, you know. And he said, well, you know, my chicken died too, you know. So it wasn't that bad, you know. And then I remember when I walked out of there, it was like there was a weight lifted off my shoulders. I walked out of there lighter. And that to me is the spiritual experience. Because what I learned from you people in Alcoholics Anonymous is that, or what I believe is that my higher power is within me. And all those years of drinking and selfish and self-centered action is what piled on top of each other on it and ended up blocking me from that higher power. That higher power that my parents tried to teach me about in church. That higher power with people that are good, go around and do good things naturally, expecting nothing in return, that I'd never, ever tried to do. That's all that stuff inside was blocking me from him, from my higher power. And so when I go and get rid of that stuff, I can feel it. I can feel that, okay, this... Sometimes when I would watch these movies, even when I was drunk, and I would see something good happen, I would feel tingly, like, that's good. Well, I feel it right now, because that's good. We're talking about good stuff. Or I'm talking about good stuff. But I just hadn't experienced anything like that. And so I got rid of that stuff. And what I learned is I needed to learn to love myself for who I was before I could ever really care about somebody else or could ever give that love to them. Even my family, which I never really wholeheartedly cared. So we went on and did that fifth step, and what he identified was the things that were wrong with me. The seven deadly sins, the characteristics that were outside of God and society, and now I know what to pray for, or what to have God to pray to remove. Because if I thought I was full of gluttony and sloth and lust and all that and anger and mostly I was full of pride, you know, pride and a little bit of anger and fear. I had a lot of fear. So I identified those things, and I know what to ask God to help remove. We went on through Mike Cain just told me to let go and let God, so I'm going to get ready to wrap this up. Send a text. I went through and I did the amends that my sponsor told me to do. And this was more, it got me closer to my higher power. This is more getting rid of the baggage, because I don't have to regret that stuff that I did in the past anymore. All those girlfriends that I mistreated and judged and did bad things to, and were selfish and self-centered too, I didn't get to go talk to one of them. I thought that was going to be the best part of my night step, but he's like, man, you don't need to, they probably don't forgot all about you, you know, you don't need to bring that stuff up. Go pay the people back you owe money, and then some of the stuff I couldn't do or find the people or whatever, so, you know, volunteer work at Habitat for Humanity or spend the night in a homeless shelter, give back to the community, stuff you took away from them, you know, and those were my amends. The biggest amends were to my parents and family that I was treated, and those I'm still making today. They trust me, and I'm dependable, and today I'm a member of a good member of society. Along that way, I met a girl and got married and had a daughter, and I named her Shannon after my friend who died. And I haven't been entirely successful financially in life, but I'm happy, and I'm joyous, and I'm free, and I have a couple guys that I sponsor, and I try to do what I can for somebody else and expect nothing in return, even though that's not my nature. And that's about enough for me. Thank you.